This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, speaking with reporters within the last half hour, presented the latest version of his argument that the media focus on violence in Iraq overshadows real progress.
Our plan called for the establishment of an Iraqi cabinet of ministers, and the coalition did it in 4 months. It took 14 months in post-war Germany. The plan called for the establishment of an independent Iraqi central bank. The coalition did it in 2 months. It took 3 years in post-war Germany. Our plan called for the establishment of a new Iraqi currency. The coalition announced a new currency in 2 months and began circulating new Iraqi dinars in 5 months. It took 3 years in post-war Germany.
Those comments come amid continuing violence in Iraq. The United Nations today pulled more of its staff members out of Baghdad, at least for now, and some international aid agencies are doing the same. In Washington, as the Bush administration faces more questions about Iraq policy, Secretary Rumsfeld, one of its principal architects, is coming under fire. As recently as last spring, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was the star of the Bush cabinet. After 9/11, his self-confidence and determination resonated with the American people, and he received great credit when the military campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq quickly toppled the Taliban and Saddam Hussein. In recent weeks, though, Secretary Rumsfeld sniped publicly at the National Security Advisor, snubbed the leadership of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and wrote a private memo that, once leaked, appeared to contradict the positive public message coming out of both the White House and the Pentagon. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Secretary Rumsfeld's critics and his supporters. We'll find out a bit about his surprising record back in the Nixon administration and hear more about his controversial policies. If you have questions about his policies, his leadership style, or his future, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with Michael Duffy, White House Bureau Chief of Time Magazine. He joins us by phone from his office, and good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here, Neil.
In an article you wrote titled, Is Rumsfeld Losing His Mojo?, you say the Secretary of Defense has been strewing political wreckage on both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue, unquote. Is he in real trouble?
Well, you know, Rumsfeld is a little bit like a tracking stock. You know, when the war was going well, Rumsfeld seems to have a great reputation, and when it begins to slide, he seems to fall also. What's odd about what's happened in the last 10 days is that he seemed to be actively part of the problem. There was the memo that he wrote, which raised all kinds of questions about the progress in the war on terror, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, worldwide, really. And that we don't recall a lot of Rumsfeld papers leaking, and this one leaked fast. And then, of course, he upset his friends on Capitol Hill, the ones who really have been his supporters and carried his water for years. He seemed to go out of his way to just ignore them in the last 10 days, which suggested to me that he was coming a little unglued.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that incident. This was in response to a letter that the ranking member and the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senators Warner and Levin, sent him this hand-delivered letter asking about the behavior of General Boykin, who made some controversial remarks about the war on terrorism. Let's just leave it there and go from the criticism of Boykin to the letter and how it was handled.
Well, these letters, you know, it's reasonable if listeners think, yeah, letters go from Capitol Hill to the Pentagon all the time, and that's true, but these are a little bit like getting email rockets from your boss. These are the two most important people on the Hill to the Pentagon, the people who really are in charge of making sure they get what they want financially and in the budget. And they're not ignored. They're the most important documents that move in that direction. And Warner took extraordinary steps to make sure Rumsfeld saw it fast. So when he was asked a couple of days later, had he seen this letter? It's like getting a letter from your boss. Rumsfeld said, well, it may be in the building somewhere, but I haven't seen it. It was just impossible to believe. And that's when Warner went to the floor and said, you know, I will not put up with this. Warner used to be a Navy secretary himself. His office is done up very much like almost like a captain's ward. And it's a very serious relationship that Rumsfeld had not taken seriously enough. That required Rumsfeld then to sort of invite Warner over for lunch very quickly the next day, and he apologized in that session last Friday. But there is the problem here is that the Pentagon, and Rumsfeld in particular, has always treated the Hill all through this war as a kind of a nuisance. And it finally boiled over when he did it to Warner, of all people. Today, right now, even as we speak, Neil, he's having this press conference. It's live, and he's still trying to undo the damage of both the memo and the Warner comment last week.
But the most serious transgression may have been, when he was sniping actively at the White House, and that involved what some have described as a tantrum thrown with reporters present.
Well, this is the most extraordinary thing about when the public opinion about the war began to slide in late August. The White House came back and they did two things. They said, let's go to the UN and ask for more money and more troops. And that was aimed as much at the American public as it was at the UN. They wanted to reassure the public that they were back on the international track. Bush has done this literally almost every September that he's been in office, for good reasons. But that effort stalled. And when it stalled, the White House tried a second tack. It announced suddenly on a Sunday night that all Iraq policymaking would be headquartered at the National Security Council, which is run by Condi Rice. And she's almost as reassuring as Rumsfeld is controversial. Now, this wasn't really going to change anything. It was mostly for show. They wanted to send a reassuring signal that perhaps the Pentagon wasn't the right place to place all our faith. But rather than just saying nothing, Rumsfeld had some reporters in from the Financial Times, this is about 3 weeks ago now, and said, this isn't going to change a thing. I'm still in charge. All these people still report to me. Bremer still reports to me. All the troops still report to me, so I don't really care what paper Condi puts out or leaks. I'm still in charge of Iraq. Well, this was extraordinary. This was like practically a declaration of independence, and cabinet officers generally don't get away with it. But he did, because he was right. It wasn't going to change much. But it has led to an overall feeling, I think, by a lot of people at the White House that perhaps Rumsfeld is certainly out on the edge of what's appropriate, even for a Secretary of Defense who has rock star popularity or has had it.
President Bush is famously loyal to those who work with him, and Secretary Rumsfeld, and we're going to hear more about this in the past, has shown extraordinary abilities to survive political masters who were somewhat mercurial at times. Is there a possibility that he's going to be in trouble with his boss?
Well, I don't think George Bush is going to abandon anybody in the middle of this fight, but I also think that this president is not as loyal as his father was. I think he's much more quick. He got rid of his Treasury Secretary. He's much more quick to abandon people if they aren't up to performance. And we'll have to see. They have gone through some periods over the summer, Neil, where they made it pretty clear they didn't want Rumsfeld on television because they had no way to predict what was going to come out of his mouth, and that's not the way they like to run things. And he stayed out of sight for a good part of September. Most recently, he's been back on television trying to clean up the mess he helped create. I think we're a ways away from seeing Rumsfeld say goodbye before the end of the term, but there aren't a lot of people who think he'll be around for a second if the president wins a second.
Let's get a call from a listener. Joel joins us on the line from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hi, I was just wondering if the tensions between the State Department and the Defense Department don't go back to when the State Department disbelieved the Iraqi National Congress and Shalabi and all the intelligence that justified the war in Iraq to begin with. And now that these stories are beginning to surface in the mainstream media, maybe they're Rumsfeld as being prepped as a scapegoat for, he accepted this faulty intelligence that came from Chalabi and the INC.
Joel, thanks very much for the question. Michael Duffy, is the Secretary of Defense being set up as a scapegoat?
Well, I think we'd probably need one of those chaos theory charts, Neil, to understand who's being set up for blame by who in Washington at this moment. There's so many fingers being pointed about so many different parts of the intelligence between the Hill and the CIA and the State Department and Chalabi and the hardliners. I mean, it's getting to the point where I almost need a huge chart in my wall just to keep track of the scapegoating futures. I think the differences in philosophy go back 25 years. You can chart them at least a detente when the Republican Party had a big disagreement with itself about whether, we should trust, an internationalist approach in foreign policy. And that's kind of represented by the State Department and the CIA. and George Bush's father, and all of and most of the people who were in that administration, and the hardliners, some neoconservatives, some just more America First, who believe that we shouldn't, you know, worry too much about what the UN thinks and our allies think. We should go do what we want to do and we need to do, and that our interests require us to do. And that debate is the one that's at the that's the fulcrum of the whole Bush administration in foreign policy, and it affects every issue, affects every piece of intelligence, and increasingly affects everything that's going on. So these debates have roots that are generation old, and didn't really start with this administration.
Thanks very much for joining us today.
You bet, Neil.
Michael Duffy is Washington Bureau Chief of Time Magazine. One of the authors of this week's article is Rumsfeld Losing His Mojo. He joined us from his office in Washington, D.C. And joining us now is James Mann. He's the Senior Writer in Residence at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. He has a soon-to-be-published book about President Bush's war cabinet, and he's the author of an article in the November issue of the Atlantic Monthly entitled Young Rumsfeld. And thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Neil.
There's a passage in this article that talks about Mr. Rumsfeld giving a speech one day and then being asked by reporters if he's being viewed with open hostility at the White House. And of course, it's not the Bush White House we're talking about. It's the Nixon White House.
That's right. Rumsfeld came into the Nixon administration from several years in Congress. And he was assigned a job that he didn't really originally seek. He was the head of the anti-poverty program. And unlike some instances we've seen more recently where someone gets appointed to run an agency with kind of a liberal mission and tries to gut it, Rumsfeld took this on as a mission, and he really defended the program and its bureaucracy and its turf within the Nixon administration, to the point where the people in the Nixon White House were getting a little bit restive about what Rumsfeld up to.
Became to be known in what was perceived at the time as a very conservative White House, as a moderate, even a progressive.
That's right. And this went on. His first, I found in spending a lot of time with the Nixon tapes and the Nixon archives.
And we should be clear, you're not going back to sources and people remembering what they said all these years ago.
No, this is the tapes and especially the documents. And what's fascinating and ironic to look back now, Rumsfeld puts in 2 years as head of the anti-poverty program, and then he moves to the Nixon, to the White House, where he's just a staff member without a specific agency or a mission. And he's trying to get involved in foreign policy. And two things happen. His first effort is he wants to be in charge of post-war reconstruction in Vietnam. And so his first move in Southeast Asia. And so his first move into foreign policy is to take on post-war reconstruction, which I think right now, as people would say, is not his forte within the current administration.
And became known as a dove within the administration.
Then he became one of the ringleaders, or the ringleader of a group of domestic policy officials within the Nixon administration, who were privately asking Nixon and Kissinger, what's taking so long? Why can't we get out of Vietnam? And so I found at one point on the tapes, Rumsfeld's just challenged Kissinger at a staff meeting, and Nixon says, well, you know, let's dump him. And the context was, let's dump him because he's a dove.
We're going to be talking more about the young Rumsfeld and his history back in the Nixon administration when we come back from a break. And we're also going to hear from supporters and critics of Secretary Rumsfeld's more recent policies and more recent character traits. And as we'll be hearing also from James Mann, some of those character traits have not changed a great deal since his time in the Nixon administration. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, but we're going to break away for a news update. A congressional office building is locked down here in Washington after what appears to be a security breach. The Cannon office building houses members of Congress. It's right across the street from the Capitol building. Capitol Police have just held a news conference, and NPR's congressional correspondent David Wellner joins us now from Capitol Hill. Good of you to be with us, David.
Yes, Neil. In fact, I'm standing right outside the Cannon office building, right outside the doors, which are right now closed with hundreds of people inside.
And what did the Capitol Police tell you has happened?
Well, a spokeswoman for the Capitol Police said that they believe that a man who came in with a backpack in a black suit, white shirt, that she said age 20 to 23, 5'3", First, we heard that he may have been acting strangely when his cell phone went through, and they looked at his backpack x-rayed going through the machine and saw what they believed to be a gun in there. He grabbed that backpack before they could grab it and ran off into the building. A spokeswoman for the police just said that they now believe this was a revolver in the backpack, possibly a .38 caliber revolver. And also said that this man appeared to be with a woman who is also unaccounted for, and they have not reported sighting either of them since that incident. They were both coming in the southeast entrance to the Cannon building, going through the regular screening procedures when this happened.
So just to be clear, the police are now looking for two people inside the Cannon office building?
Yes, two people, one of whom they believe has a gun. And at first, Congressman Bob May, who is the chairman of the Rules Committee in the House, he's actually more like the mayor, David Ryer, is the chairman of the Rules Committee.
That's right.
He said that it wasn't clear exactly whether this was a gun or not, but the spokeswoman for the police said that they have determined that it was a gun.
Now, what is the status of the building? You're standing right outside. The doors are closed, you said.
The doors are closed, and you can see inside there are many, many people milling around inside, members of Congress, staff. There are some members of Congress outside the building, and they're not letting people go in or out. And it's not clear what's going to happen in terms of the work of Congress, since there are many votes being taken on the floor of the House today. This is the House office building.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, things are sort of in a holding pattern.
Do we know what the police are doing? Are they going door to door to look for these two people?
They did not explain what they're doing. They said that, for one thing, that they are actually checking very carefully everybody who is in the building. And apparently, they are letting people now go through the tunnel to go and vote. And they're checking their belongings to make sure everything is on the up and up.
The Cannon office building is a multi-story office building and includes levels underground. And as David just referred to, there's a tunnel that goes from that to the Capitol. They don't have to go out onto the street to actually leave the building. Thanks very much, David, and keep us up to date.
You're quite welcome, Neil.
NPR's David Wellner with us from Capitol Hill. Of course, NPR News will continue to follow this story through the day. Going back to our main subject this hour, and that is the problems being faced by Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. Right now we're speaking with James Mann, who wrote an article entitled Young Rumsfeld in the November issue of the Atlantic Monthly. And, of course, if you'd like to join the discussion, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And before the break, James Mann, you were talking about Rumsfeld back in the Nixon administration as a White House aide and also head of the OEO. He was both at one time and then later just an aide at the White House, who became identified as a political liberal, speaking out on behalf of poverty programs that some wanted gutted, and becoming something of a dove on the war in Vietnam. But from the tapes that that were recorded of his meetings with President Nixon, and these were tapes where he was really looking to President Nixon as a mentor, really, we see a little bit of the personality of Donald Rumsfeld.
That's right. What comes out, of course, Nixon loved one of his real hobbies, and this continued, you know, long after he stepped down from the presidency, was to give political advice. And so Rumsfeld had one thing that other White House aides didn't, which is he'd had a political career, he'd run for office, and he was planning to run for something again. And So he would go in about every couple months. He'd go in and he'd sit down and he'd have these one-on-one talks with Nixon, which were fascinating both for what they said of Rumsfeld, what they said of Nixon. Nixon would dispense advice on what to do in foreign policy, what was good for your career and what wasn't. One of the funny ones, ironic in retrospect, is he kept telling Rumsfeld, stay away from the Middle East. No good can come of your career if you get involved in the Middle East. He told Rumsfeld, who had no idea then that he would become defense secretary twice, you don't want to become a service secretary, secretary of the Army, Navy, Air Force, because really they're just warts. They don't have much to do.
He was disliked by Nixon's staff members, Haldeman and Ehrlichman and Henry Kissinger, for what they would describe as, I guess, his raw ambition. And at one point they said, gee, we thought he was presidential material somewhere down the road. And President Nixon says, no, I don't think he has the spine.
Doesn't have the backbone. That's exactly right. Rumsfeld had a way of he would push his own agency, his own agenda, his own issues. And he would take people on. And it was a constant in all three or four, if you count the Reagan administration, administrations he served in. He's made enemies because he'll challenge people. You know, someone like his close associate, Dick Cheney, always sort of left people thinking, this may not come out your way, but don't worry, this is just business. Well, Rumsfeld would come right at you. If you'd come at him with an argument, and he'd say, that's bull.
He seemed to like confrontation, you're right, and challenging the
He certainly didn't shrink from confrontation, exactly. Mm-hmm.
There's much more interesting in James Mann's article in the upcoming issue of the Atlantic Monthly, including the relationship with Dick Cheney and Frank Carlucci, also in that office, interestingly enough, three future secretaries of defense in the anti-poverty agency at the Nixon administration, and about how Secretary Rumsfeld managed to avoid a lot of the opprobrium of the Watergate investigation by the luck of having been appointed to be an ambassador to NATO at the time.
Good timing, exactly.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Neil.
James Mann is the author, as I mentioned, of that recent article about Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. It's in the November issue of the Atlantic Monthly, and he was with us here in Studio 3A. Joining us now is Lauren Thompson. He's a defense analyst at the Lexington Institute, a nonpartisan think tank in Arlington, Virginia, also with us in Studio 3A. Thanks for coming in today.
Hi, Neil.
We've invited you in to give us some historical perspective on the Secretary of Defense. Obviously, his tenure is not up, and his place in history will be determined by a lot of things. One of them is going to be how the war with Iraq turns out. Premature to make any pronouncements on that at the moment. But how would you suspect he's doing right now if he got run over by a bus today or resigned?
Well, let's bear in mind that the preponderance of his career is already behind him. He's done a number of major things. He wasn't just the 21st defense secretary. He was also the 13th. And he was the ambassador to NATO. And he was elected to Congress for four terms. And he was the chairman of two Fortune 500 corporations, and on and on and on. He's larger than life, and that's the way he's going to be remembered.
And he certainly captured the American public's attention in a way no Secretary of Defense ever had in the days after 9/11.
Yes, he seems to have a remarkable facility for communicating through the electronic media. He's not faring quite so well these days in the print media, but he has a bluntness and a clarity about him that most political figures even now lack, and that has allowed him to connect, at least since 9/11, very effectively with the public.
Obviously, the policies with which he is most publicly identified are the war on terrorism, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. He came into the Pentagon, though, as a champion of the idea of military transformation,
yes,
of making a lighter, faster, smaller, more agile army in particular.
Yes, that's correct. Probably the most important foundation statement for that came from the President Bush before he was president, when he was a candidate on the election trail back in 1999. He gave a speech at a military academy called the Citadel, in which he said he was going to give his defense secretary a mandate to challenge the status quo and envision a new architecture for American defense. Rumsfeld has embraced that mission with a vengeance.
And he had previously been on a commission that looked at some of the ways that the military might be modernized. At the same time, inevitably, when you come in with a brief to change things at an institution the size of the Department of Defense, you're going to ruffle a few feathers. And as we mentioned, the character, personality, the way he addresses problems, has not exactly endeared him to a lot of the men and women who wear stars in that building.
That's true, but it may be what was required. Remember, he serves a president who was barely elected, and there wasn't a great sense of urgency when he came in terms of threats. We felt relatively unchallenged before 9/11. It took his personality, I think, to impose the kind of fundamental, multifaceted change on the building that we're now beginning to see. Transformation has turned into a real thing, but without the force of his personality, it would not be a reality.
Our number again is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Let's get a call in from Adam, who's in Denver, Colorado.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I'm interested in Rumsfeld's involvement with the group called the Project for the New American Century prior to becoming a part of the Bush administration, and to what degree things that you see him encouraging nowadays are really part and parcel of this group's every dream coming true.
The Project for the New American Century was put together by William Kristol and others now identified as neoconservatives.
Well, the Project for the New American Century is just the latest manifestation of what you might call a political subculture that has been present in the Republican Party for over a generation now. As was mentioned earlier in the program, you can go back some time and find Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, and many other people interacting on these issues over a period of multiple administrations. These are folks who believe in a real politic, somewhat ideological approach to the world, and they're, if not strident, at least determined to prevail.
And another one, of course, is Richard Perle. And there's an element not only of those people you mentioned, but of former Democrats, I guess, known as Scoop Jackson Democrats, who were pro-defense but liberal on social policies, who joined this group.
No doubt about it. Mr. Perle, who is now on the Defense Policy Board, until recently he was the chairman, recently told me he still considers himself a Democrat, which is a certain amount of definitional looseness, I would say, today. But these people have believed what they believe going way back into the Cold War. They share common values, and maybe to some degree the reason why they're in trouble today is because they spend a lot of time talking to each other and echoing each other's sentiments, not as receptive to other points of view.
What's most interesting to me is, you know, if you look at their website and, you know, where they outline their dream for the world, what the world will look like whenever it looks the way they want it to, it seems that everything that has happened since they got one of their guys in office has, their every dream has come true.
I think there's a lot to that. People have this misconception that Iraq and the axis of evil are a result of 9/11. Much of what's happened since 9/11 are things this administration wanted to do, but for which it lacked a mandate prior to 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Adam, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Wanted to ask you also, you know, how much trouble do you think he's in? We've been talking about some of the difficulties he's had since his various public blow-ups and his leaked memo and that sort of thing.
I actually don't think he's in much trouble at all. Most of the people who are characterizing his troubles in the public media today have very little in common with the president or with the values that this administration's pursuing. Donald Rumsfeld has a lot in common with Dick Cheney, with George W. Bush, and with a school of thought which he has championed for most of his adult life. So I think the job is his as long as he wants it.
Our guest is Lauren Thompson of the Lexington Institute. We're discussing Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, his policies, and his political problems that he's facing at the moment. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in. Annette joins us on the line from San Francisco.
Yeah, I understand, particularly from reading Al Franken's book, that there was quite a plan in place to deal with terrorism, that they made it a number one priority during the transition.
Annette, we're having a little problem with your cell phone.
Sorry, there was a sense of urgency about terrorism when Rumsfeld took office. Why didn't he act on the Clinton plan? And there was a sense of urgency, and the Clinton administration had really gone a long way to transforming the military. It was the Clinton military that won the war in Iraq. So why isn't Rumsfeld being held accountable for failing to act on the transition plan that the Clinton administration provided with respect to terrorism?
Okay, Annette, thanks for the call. We're going to let you in your cell phone call, I'm afraid. Go, Lauren?
Well, if I could take you back again to that major campaign speech on national security that presidential candidate George W. Bush gave in 1999, he stressed that the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and the presence of radical terrorists around the world were a major focus. We can't really blame Rumsfeld for not being ready. He'd only been there a few months. And in fact, what he was encountering during the few months before 9/11 was a lot of pushback from Congress, from the military services. The resistance diminished after the attacks. He saw the danger to a much greater degree than most of the other people in the system did.
Yeah, a lot of people have written that international affairs and countering Iraq was not high on the president's agenda. It was not, the burning issue it was after 9/11, but was not one of his most important issues until after the attacks.
I would suspect that George W. Bush was headed in for Iraq before 9/11 for reasons that are pretty obvious. But on the other hand, he did allude on the campaign trail and during his early months in office to the challenge that was posed by North Korea, by Iran, by Iraq. He later called them the axis of evil. But I think this was a strategy that was shared by Cheney, by Rumsfeld, long before there was an overt terrorist attack on the continental United States.
Let's get a call in from Joe, who's in Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, how y'all doing today?
Okay.
Good. I was I wanted to find out about the relationship between Secretary Colin Powell and Secretary Rumsfeld. I know from the very beginning they seemed to lock horns, and they haven't been able to get along ever since. But it seems that one time Secretary Powell was out of the loop, so to speak, and they were almost making fun of him. Mm-hmm. And now he seems that the way he's handled the world press and the world, you know, the other nations and the United Nations, that he has done much more of trying to bring the other people of the world together to help us with this problem of terrorism that we seem to have lost after 9/11.
Well,
and I'm wondering if his policies and the way he thinks are going to edge out Rumsfeld in the long run.
Thanks for the call, Joe.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, there's a true political rivalry there for influence, as is often the case. Caspar Weinberger had the same problem with George Shultz in terms of contending for the president's ear. However, I think there's a more fundamental divide in terms of ideology. Colin Powell is basically a liberal internationalist. The president, Cheney, Rumsfeld, or not.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
Sure.
Lauren Thompson is a defense analyst at the Lexington Institute, a nonpartisan think tank in Arlington, Virginia. He also teaches at Georgetown University, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. We're talking about the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and when we come back from our break, we're going to be talking with one of his great fans, Midge Dichter, the author of a new book called Rumsfeld. But here are a few of the stories NPR News is working on this afternoon. As we mentioned earlier, a congressional office building, the Cannon Building, is locked down as police search for a man who apparently brought a revolver through security there. Also today, new figures show that the economy grew at its strongest pace in nearly 20 years. The GDP grew at a 7.2% annual rate in the third quarter of this year. And wildfires continue to burn through Southern California. They've claimed 20 lives so far, 2,600 homes, and they've scorched nearly 1,200 square miles. Details on those stories coming up on All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be back with more on Secretary Rumsfeld after a break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're discussing Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and how his leadership is ruffling feathers at the White House and in Congress. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Midge Dichter, an author and editor whose essays and reviews have appeared in Harper's, The Weekly Standard, The Atlantic Monthly, and she's just published a book titled Rumsfeld, A Personal Portrait. She joins us from our bureau in New York, and thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You've been listening to the program from the top of the hour.
Have we
been discussing the Donald Rumsfeld that you know?
Well, only to some extent. You've been discussing the Donald Rumsfeld, except for the gentleman from the Lexington Institute. You've been discussing the Donald Rumsfeld that one reads about every morning in the newspapers. But that is not the Donald Rumsfeld I have known for 20 years.
Now you got,
not at all.
You got extraordinary access to him in
yes.
order to write this book.
Yes, I did.
Tell us something.
But, of course, he was conducting a war at the time, which was a slight interruption.
I bet. But it made the time awfully interesting that you did have.
Yes.
Tell us something you know that many of us might find surprising.
What you might find surprising is that he is probably the only figure in Washington, in the government, who never manipulates.
Never manipulates?
No, he does not. And that's one of the reasons that people get very angry with him. And they describe this as being disrespectful to them, whereas, of course, it's actually being very respectful toward them, because he does not manipulate anybody. He doesn't fool around. He doesn't give backward answers to questions. And the great fuss, by the way, over this memo about the war on terror being a long slog is a complete mystery to me. I'll bet you there are 25 such memos somewhere in the files of the Pentagon, because what he was saying is this is a long slog, and that's true. We had a brilliant victory in Iraq. That was a military war. But a war on terror is something else, and it's something that I should say that democratic people are not that brilliant at fighting. We'd do a lot better at it if we had a more beastly government, because they, if you notice, if you look around, most of the beastlier governments in this world are not as troubled by terror as we are.
And Democrat, you were speaking the small d in that.
Small d.
Yes.
Yes.
Email question we had from John Henry Miller in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He said, I'd seen a photograph of Don Rumsfeld meeting with Saddam Hussein. What was he doing meeting with Saddam Hussein?
I haven't seen a photograph of him meeting with Saddam Hussein at all. So I don't know, but I do know what he was doing meeting with Saddam Hussein. He had gone to Saddam Hussein on an errand from Ronald Reagan. The Iran-Iraq war was on, and the United States was attempting to lean in whichever direction would keep the war going longer, because it was perhaps cynical, but a policy to want to keep that war going. And since Iraq was weakening and Iran was winning, though Iraq had initially declared that war, Reagan wanted to keep the balance. And so he sent Rumsfeld, who was then a private citizen, to the Middle East with a letter saying, we were prepared to do something in the direction of recognizing his government. This is now taken to be some deep, dark secret, but it wasn't a deep, dark secret. It's there in the record. And it's not the first cynical thing that was ever done by a United States government. And I sincerely hope, because I would like to see this country kept safe for a very long time, that it won't be the last.
How do you think he's doing? As you were, again, had this access to him during this extraordinary moment in history, and I'm sure you've been following, as you indicated you were, all this latest kerfuffle, including his sniping at Condoleezza Rice and the rest of it. How do you think he's doing at the moment, particularly with his boss?
Well, I don't think he was sniping at Condoleezza Rice, by the way. I think he was sniping at the journalist who repeated the question to him about three times. And I think that's where the sniping came in. I don't think he was sniping at Condoleezza Rice. He's very regimental about his relations with his colleagues, including Colin Powell. The State Department has said nasty things about him. They've issued little State Department nasty secrets and sayings about him. He, on the other hand, has never been heard to say one nasty thing about them and about Colin Powell. You can't get him to. I tried, and I failed.
Before we let you go, tell us a little bit about Rumsfeld's rules.
Well, Rumsfeld's rules is a collection by now of many pages of species of wisdom in aphorisms about based on his experience. Some of them are about being chief of staff in the White House. Some of them are about dealing with the enemy. Some of them are about running a corporation. Some of them are about life. And as the years have gone on, he's collected them. Some of them are very witty. Some of them are very wise. And the funny thing is, as this thing has gotten very long, I don't know how many pages now, about six or eight, the very last one is, and if you do have rules, never make more than 10.
There's also a famous one. A friend in Washington is someone who stabs you in the chest.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that was not one of his rules. That was something that was said in the commission that he chaired, the Commission on Weapons in Space.
Mm-hmm.
He was the I know someone who served on that commission. And he is the cause. He is not only witty himself, he's the cause that wit is in others. And while they were discussing this really fearful subject, they were kind of vying with one another to say funny things. Probably it helped them keep their spirits up. And he collected all these. He called them brilliant pebbles. And that was one of the brilliant pebbles.
Midge Dector, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Midge Dector is the author of the recently published book, Rumsfeld, A Personal Portrait. She joined us from our bureau in New York. With us now is David Reif, who's the author of this Sunday's New York Times Magazine's cover story entitled Blueprint for a Mess, How the Bush Administration's Pre-War Planners Bungled Post-War Iraq. He joins us on the phone from Madrid in Spain, and thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us, David.
Happy to be with you.
We were just hearing a little bit from Midge Dector about relations with the State Department. One of the items that comes up in your article is how the turf war between the Pentagon and the State Department is, I guess in your judgment, responsible for, at least in part, a little bit of the mess in post-war Iraq.
Well, it's responsible for a lot of the mess in post-war Iraq. The fact of the matter is that the State Department, for more than a year before the Iraq War started, had initiated a quite comprehensive and, I think, rather brilliant effort to bring together American experts in the Arab world, State Department officials, people in the NGO and civil society communities in the United States with special interests in post-conflict activities, people like David Phillips at the Council on Foreign Relations and other well-known experts in the field, and most importantly, the widest imaginable gamut of Iraqi exile and political figures in the Iraqi diaspora, got them together, put them into task forces, got them really to talk to each other in many cases for the first time. It was a tremendous success for American diplomacy. It was run by an Arabist in the State Department called Thomas Warwick under the aegis of Deputy Secretary Armitage and Secretary Powell. This group produced incredible reports from everything about Iraq, from how the legal system might be restructured, to indeed thinking about the immediate post-war. And incidentally, this group warned about the possibility of massive looting and a massive breakdown of law and order. The Pentagon won the turf war about who would control basically the money and indeed the institutions that would oversee post-war Iraq on behalf of the Provisional Authority, what we now call the Coalition Provisional Authority. Pentagon won this turf war and threw the whole thing out. Ms. Dector may be right that Colin Powell has never said, at least in public, something disobliging about Secretary Powell, but I would frankly add, I'm not aware that Secretary Powell has said anything in public about Secretary Rumsfeld, but the fact of the matter is that the State Department was frozen out of the planning and had actually done some planning. And what instead happened is the Pentagon, in what I view as its arrogance, an arrogance that for me flows from the top, that is from Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz, decided basically they didn't need any of these experts, they didn't want any of these State Department Arabists, and the only Iraqi exile they cared about was Ahmad Chalabi. And so they did it all over again, except they only had 2 months to do it, because when they took it over, it was about 2 months before the war started. So in effect, we went in to one of the most important undertakings of the early part of the 21st century, an undertaking that literally is a matter of life and death for our country, with no plan. That's what happened, and that you can lay at the door of Mr. Rumsfeld, charming and intelligent though he may be.
David Reif is the author of this coming Sunday's New York Times Magazine cover story entitled Blueprint for a Mess, How the Bush Administration's Pre-War Planners Bungled Post-War Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And David, another issue that you write a lot about in this article is you mentioned Mr. Chalabi, the man that was trumpeted by the Pentagon as the man who would likely take over relatively easily and relatively smoothly in Iraq. It certainly has not played out that way.
Well, Richard Perle, a noted neoconservative figure close to the administration, one of the many people in the administration who refused to talk to me for this New York Times article, has said that he still thinks using Chalabi would have been a better idea. The fact is that the Pentagon believed that Chalabi, who was someone they'd known since the early 90s, who appeared on many panels in Washington with people who would later join the Defense Department. I'm talking about Douglas Feith, the head of policy, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. I'm talking obviously about Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I'm also talking about neoconservatives close to the administration and in semi-official capacities like Richard Perle and Ken Edelman, or indeed Elliot Abrams at NSC. I mean, in other words, that strain of the Bush administration that is neoconservative, and the Bush administration is by no means an entirely neoconservative administration. I'm not sure Donald Rumsfeld is a neoconservative. In fact, I rather think he is not. But these guys really believed in Chalabi. They thought Chalabi was the man who could transform Iraq. Chalabi arrives in Iraq, having won, as I say, the institutional turf war in Washington, gotten the support of the Pentagon, which was running post-war Iraq. He's flown to the deserts of al-Nasiriyah in south-central Iraq with 500 Iraqi fighters, and the military quickly see that the guy basically has no support on the ground, which is hardly surprising since he hadn't been in Iraq in 40 years. I mean, one of the things that was so frustrating writing this magazine piece for the New York Times was wondering how this war, which I oppose, but I think you can legitimately defend the cause of this war, and indeed I think you can legitimately defend the project of wanting to overthrow Saddam Hussein, but how on earth can intelligent people like Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz have imagined that a guy who hadn't been in Iraq in 40 years could win the loyalty of the Iraqi people? I've been a lot in Iraq since the end of the war. I travel mostly in Iraq among Iraqis, not among coalition authorities. I don't travel with the U.S. military. I travel in the slums of Baghdad and indeed in the south and in the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. And I don't hear anyone do anything except laugh or spit when they think about Chalabi. And yet Chalabi was the man before the war. So in effect, what happened was, because of this idiocy at the Pentagon, We've had to start from scratch. Now, we still make a go of things in Iraq. I didn't write a piece saying it was hopeless. But we have gotten ourselves into a situation because of a kind of blind faith in Ahmed Chalabi, poor planning, and a turf war which was absolutely ruthless, in which it appears to me, from my reporting, that the Pentagon froze out the State Department, basically blackballed this man Warrick, wouldn't let him be part of the team for the post-war, even though he was the great expert in the field, and even though General Garner wanted him, you know, thing after thing after thing. So that in effect, you know, we're starting from this big hole we dug for ourselves. That, I'm afraid, is the reality of the Pentagon's post-war planning.
David Reif, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
David Reif, the author of the coming Sunday New York Times Magazine cover story entitled Blueprint for a Mess, How the Bush Administration's Pre-War Planners Bungled Post-War Iraq. He was on the phone with us from Madrid. And the security scare on Capitol Hill we were speaking about earlier is over. Officials say it was a toy gun, part of a Halloween costume, that set off concerns at the Cannon Office Building opposite the Capitol in Washington, D.C. So again, the situation on Capitol Hill has been resolved. You can hear details later from NPR News. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.